Here we are with Ultra Footwear's founder, Golden Harper. And as you know, if you've been listening, we do the Ultra Performance Gait Tips and bring on all their ultra athletes and talk about how to watch your gait, become more efficient, and use the shoe and your body to reach from start to finish in the most efficient fashion. I'd like to welcome Golden Harper here, who's a runner himself. And if you just followed a little bit of his history, at age 10, he runs a marathon at 3:08. You know you have something when you're 10 years old and you're knocking out a 3:08 marathon. Comes back at 11 and runs a 2:57, and at 12, a 2:45 finish. Amazing. Runs not too recent past, a 50 miler and wins it on his debut, Alpine to Slick Rock 50 mile. Welcome, Golden Harper, founder of Ultra Footwear.
Hey, thanks for having me. You're embarrassing me.
Well, good thing we don't have Skype cameras rolling, and I could see the new shade of red on the face.
I know, you'd see my red face right now.
Hey, Ultra has really, really come onto the scene, and nothing harder than this recent weekend at Leadville 100, where you guys have had some great success. Why don't you share a little bit about what your athletes have done there in your shoe?
Yeah, pretty phenomenal. You know, first and second place finishes overall, and can't say unexpected. I went and ran with Ian Sharman, you know, about 2 weeks before the race, and he said he was feeling good. He felt ready, and you know, he thought it would just come down to whoever was having a better day. I know he thought Ace would be up there, and he thought those two guys would be battling it out. So. You know, it's hundreds are so unpredictable, and there's so many things that can go right or wrong. I think, you know, we're just happy that, that both those guys were able to get it done and finish 1-2. So, strong kind of front to back for, Ian, and then, a consistent performance, coming from behind. Pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, I tell you, you know, it's really fun to watch and have been partnered with you guys on some of the gait tips and watching how people are just embracing the shoe. And you guys have come with a few different models now, not only in the more minimalist side, but some of the higher cushion side. Where do you find most people are attracted to, or is it a split? What are your reads there at headquarters?
Yeah, it's crazy. It's a pretty good split. You know, we make the Superior, which is kind of a minimalist performance light and fast shoe, and then the Lone Peak, which is in the middle, and then both the Paradigm, which is my favorite mountain running shoe, and the Olympus for ultra distance, you know, ultra cushion category for those two shoes, and really our sales are pretty well split across the board. So Superior's just, you know, has been killing it earlier this year. Olympus has been strong for us for a few years now, as well as Paradigm. And then, of course, Long Peak was the second shoe we ever built and the first trail shoe we ever built. And it's kind of always been our number one seller. So, you know, we have a pretty good split. Different shoes for different uses, you know. So, and it really pleases me that we have a lot of parity there, and people are using, you know, the different platforms we make, depending on what they're trying to accomplish.
Now you're famous for cutting shoes and putting them in the home oven and baking them down. I can imagine your new research and development lab probably is a little bit more exotic and robust.
You know, a little bit, to say the least. But honestly, it really comes down to just, you know, I consider our R&D lab to be you know, the Wasatch Mountains here. I live right at the base of Lone Peak. And that's what it really comes down to. At the end of the day, all this kind of mumbo jumbo is bull crap if the shoe doesn't perform on the mountains. So I go out and I actually just finished a run, and, you know, whether I'm hammering lactate threshold intervals or pounding out, you know, long miles or doing some peak bagging, you know, we're putting shoes through the paces, and I'm famous for putting one shoe on one foot, different one on the other, and you know, really seeing how, you know, they're reacting. So it's not out of character to see me running in not matched shoes.
Okay, now that's the first. I've never heard of that, Golden. I wouldn't recommend racing in that, but I would say definitely for lab purposes, that's acceptable.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know that I've raced in unmatched shoes, but Yeah, exactly.
Hey, can we leave and depart with a running tip of some kind? Reach back into your golden tips that you might share with someone about running. What's something that you have found valuable and would like to pass forward?
You know, if we do a form tip, my biggest one for most people is just more compact arm movement. Most people don't realize it, but watch yourself run. You'll be surprised. You don't exactly run the way you think you do in your head. None of us do. And for most American runners, we just use our arms way too much. You know, the back swing should be an active motion. The forward swing should be passive. And it really should be very compact. You want to move your arms as little as possible for the speed you're going. So if you're going, you know, if you're doing a jog at 10-minute pace, your arms are probably only moving about 3 inches. And then as you speed up, you pop those elbows back farther. But at the end of the day, you know, the big thing for me is keep those arms compact and keep the elbows behind the hips unless you're sprinting. That's kind of my big one. It's just super effective for cleaning up most anybody. You can make somebody go from looking not so great or being inefficient to being pretty dang efficient in just a few quick seconds just by keeping those elbows behind the hips.
Awesome. Great tip. And if you want to go check out the shoes and see what people are running and winning in, go to ultrafootwear.com or Ultra Running. That's ALTRA. Or go to our partners page at Trail Runner Nation, click on the link, and it will shoot you right over to the grand selection of shoes at Ultra. Thanks so much, Golden Harper. We enjoyed the tip, and thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Are we recording? Dr. Romanoff, you're probably very experienced at professional interviews. This is not one of them.
Oh, come on. Don't put yourself down.
We are very casual. That's a good word.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And it was a miserable, miserable day. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman. He is Ian Torrance. We're missing Scott War today, who is out in the Sierra mountain range with a backpack on, trying to find unknown trails and having a great time. So we'll miss Scott today. But we have a guest. We have Dr. Jim Taylor. And we started back in, I think, January with Dr. Taylor on our sites and have finally reeled him in, as he is such an expert in the area that we deal with on a daily basis as trail runners. We're going to talk a little bit about pre-race management, the day of the race day, and we're going to talk a little bit about pain during the event itself and how to manage it and think about it. So he's written a couple of great articles. Let me give you a little background on, first, our co-host today, Ian. And we all know Ian, 193 ultra runs, knows a little something about running, I think 49 victories. Ian, am I right, 49?
53.
Right. 53 victories. You can find Ian Torrance at iantorrance.blogspot.com, Reinventing the Run. He's a coach over at McMillan Running Company. He runs for Team Adidas, Nathan Hydration. He's a race director for Stagecoach, 100-mile ultra run and relay. So Ian, he lives and breathes trail running. And it turns out Dr. Jim Taylor, he's a trail runner too. Let me give you a little background and then we'll hear from him as well. Dr. Jim Taylor is internationally recognized for his work in psychology of endurance sports. And if that doesn't qualify him right there, I don't know what does. He has worked with several pro cycling teams and has been a consultant to USA Triathlon, has worked junior elite, age group, world class, and Olympic athletes in cross-country skiing, triathlon, cycling, swimming, running. He's a former ski racer who competed internationally. Dr. Jim is a second-degree black belt in karate, a sub-3-hour marathoner, an Ironman triathlete, and an avid skate skier. He is an author of 14 books, including Prime Sport, Triumph of the Athlete Mind, and Triathlete's Guide to Mental Training, and has published over 750 articles and has given more than 1,000 workshops throughout the world. He blogs on sports for psychologytoday.com, huffingtonpost.com, and his own website. Dr. Jim, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Don. Ian, we'll have a lot of fun. I will also say that I live at the base of Mount Tamalpais, just north of San Francisco, and we also spend a ton of time in the Sierras, so I do a ton of trail running, too. It's a great joy to run with my my Aussie, Australian Shepherd, Thule.
Awesome. Hey, tell us a little bit about tell us about your competitive days and maybe how you got into the seat that you're in today of being a sports psychologist.
Well, Don, Ian, there's a cliche that people become psychologists to figure themselves out, and that's very much the case with me. I, as you indicated in your intro, I competed internationally as an alpine ski racer. I came to endurance sports relatively later in life, but I was known as a head case. My mind always got in the way. And I took a course. Back then, there weren't too many sports psychologists, but I took a course once related to sports psychology and turned my career around. Took a quantum leap in my ski racing rankings and performances. And so when I got to college, I went to Middlebury College in Vermont, undergraduate, took a psych class and just fell in love. And this was the path I was going to be on. And I've been doing it for quite a long time. And there's a saying, do something you love to do and you'll never work a day in your life. And I feel like I've been fortunate enough to live that kind of life.
So we mentioned that you've helped many athletes along the way. I believe Ian has a question along those lines. Ian?
Yeah, I was just curious if there were any since this is kind of a trail and / runner audience, just wondering if there were any big names that you worked with over the years that maybe we would know or recognize.
Well, there are. Unfortunately, as a psychologist, I'm legally and ethically bound to confidentiality.
Perfect.
So I'm not allowed to share my client list. I wish I could. It would be great for business, but I can't do that, unfortunately.
So what I'm going to do is list the names of the top 10 athletes of the year in ultra running community and assume that each one of those have been under the great care of Dr. Jim Taylor. Would I be out on a limb if I did that, Dr. Jim?
That would be going way out on a limb, yes.
Okay. So what are some of the things that – I mean, we've got two fun articles to reference, and we'll link those if it's with your permission because I did find them on the internet. Pre-race management. We'll talk a little bit about that phase of the day or of our events. We spend a lot of time on this podcast talking about the training and leading up to it, but in this particular article, pre-race management, it seems that you focus from the time the alarm rings in the morning to the gun goes off and you've said, hey, this is an important part of the race that you need to consider and have some type of plan if you want to be successful. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. For distance running on the trail, it's such a capricious event in so many ways in terms of terrain, conditions, weather, what happens to you in terms of your hydration and nutrition. It's a complicated experience, as Ian especially can attest to. And so it's really important that trail runners get their ducks in a row and that they have a plan. They have what I call a pre-race plan to ensure that when they get to the line, they can say say this one thing to themselves that's very important. I'm totally prepared to run my best. And so think about everything that goes into being ready for that point when the whistle blows, the gun goes off, or what have you, and make sure that there is a plan. Certainly, your nutrition is very important before the morning of, in fact, the night before. The amount of sleep you get. What you do in terms of your physical warm-up, the gear you'll need, what you do mentally to prepare. Some people like to get really fired up. Some like to really chill out. I did an off-road triathlon a few years back with a good friend of mine, a woman I train with a lot. She gets really excitable. She gets really psyched up, and I like to stay pretty chill before my races. And the morning of, she's like, comes up to me and grabs my shoulders and goes, isn't this great? And I'm thinking, okay, great. Yeah, fine. Good. Chill out. Thank you. And so another part of that routine is who you hang out with, that it will help you get into that state. If you need to get psyched up, yeah, hang out with someone like my friend. If you like to chill out, hang out with the local Zen master. So the idea is to really have an organized plan that covers all your bases.
So what I hear you saying is is that it's some people need to get keyed up like that. And the person that grabs your shoulders and starts giving you the shake of your life, that's what that community or that group needs, and they should band together. And there are others that, hey, that's the last thing. That's burning unwanted energy, and please, you know, give me a little space. Both can be correct.
Right, Don. There's no one right way to prepare for a trail race. If you talk to the top 10 men and women in the world in trail running, they will give you probably 10 different routines that they use, but they will all be composed of very similar things. They have to get their equipment ready, their nutrition ready, they need to get their themselves physically ready, and they need to get themselves mentally ready. Now, that's the basic framework for that pre-race routine, but it's up to each individual based upon their personality, their comfort zones, their habits, their styles, to figure out what works best for them.
Hey, Ian, what about you? What type of pre-race guy would we find you? Would you be hanging out with the Zen Master, or would you be over there blowing the bullhorn?
I'd be hanging out with the Zen Master. Jim talks about in his pre-race management article about those who are easily distracted, and for those people, they need to get away from the activity. And then he talks about the folks that are focused too inwardly, and they're worried about their race, and they're getting all excited. And he suggests that they stay around the activity of the start area. I think I'm more of the latter. I find myself kind of off by myself, trying to figure out what I need to do and getting my ducks in a row, rather than falling into distractions of what's going around on the start line. A lot of people like to use, they go to a race, and it's a big social occasion, and I think that's great, except I'd like to do my socializing afterwards.
So Dr. Jim, maybe help us with this. How do we not come across as a little snootish or someone that isn't social at all when we really need our Zen space? Have you provided any psychology counseling on that, when you're probably the nicest and warmest guy or gal, but pre-race you just kind of want to be separated?
Yeah, I think it's important to communicate with teammates, friends, family, what works best for you. Part of it is, are you more introverted or extroverted? Another thing is, do you get nervous? And why do you get nervous? You're worried about whether you'll make it, how fast you go, what results you'll have, who you'll beat. So a lot of it is just sort of knowing yourself, knowing what works best for you, communicating that to the people around you, and making sure you use that. As Ian suggested from my article, and this is something I advocate so much, is figure out whether you do in fact like to be left alone, where you can just either focus on the process, what you need to do to get ready, or maybe listen to music, or are you somebody who tends to think a lot, and you worry, and you question, and you doubt, and you get nervous, and you get a little scared. And in that case, the best thing to do is distract yourself. Hang out with the people who are chatting it up, goofing around, having a good time. Fun, by the way, is an incredibly important mental skill that we forget. And you know, if you're laughing, if you're smiling, you're relaxing endorphins in your brain. That's definitely going to make you feel better, make you feel happier. It'll save energy, because I tend to think that for endurance sports like trail races, you don't want to be too amped up, because then your foot is on the gas and you're revving the engine pretty high, and you're burning fuel that you're going to need during the race.
Ian, is there ever a time that you wish that you've run a lot of races and highly recognized that you wish you could just be, you know, wear a mask of being someone that maybe looked more like me and not be be recognized as a leader out there? Do you find that there's a lot of folks that try to saddle up to you and hang with you when maybe they shouldn't, or try to talk to you and get within your kitchen, if you will?
I mean, I'll be honest, there's people that I can totally hang out with. And right before a race, those are the people I usually, we split a hotel room or a house before a race. Emily, I can certainly get along with her, and she knows what I'm going through, and it works the same way when it's her race day. And But yeah, I like to stay away from the bustle, and I don't like to interact too much. People always ask the weirdest questions right before you're going to start a race. Like, how's your training been? How are you going to run today? What you going to do today? What are your goals today? And it's, those are the questions that kind of, I know they freak me out. Because I don't have an answer. And I like giving answers, and at least the best of my knowledge. And when I don't know what's going to happen, if I'm not as confident as I want to be, I don't like handling them.
hey, Ian, though, you know, the word of the trail is that you wear some pretty flashy running tights. And I've been given a lot of thought to that. I barely slept last night thinking about that. And I can see that's a very powerful mental tool you use, because when not many men can get away with really flashy running tights. And so my analysis of you is that A, you're super confident in yourself and you're comfortable in your masculinity. And second of all, use it as an intimidation factor, because if I'm coming up to you before a race and I see you wearing those stretchy trousers, I'm thinking this guy is fast, and that just makes everybody whoa. So I can see that'd be a really effective tool for you.
I'll be honest, I haven't worn my flashy tights in a couple of years now, but those are Clifton tights. Eric Clifton, he was a pretty crazy ultra runner back in the day. He has some course records and a lot of wins in his own right, and he used to have a small company, used to make those for people, and I had a small wardrobe of stretchy tights, and I like to wear them. I still have them. I just haven't put any on recently.
Hey, Ian, now, just for the record, I didn't bring it up, and I'm so glad that Dr. Taylor had the courage to bring it up about those. But just a lesson to all of us, you know, once it's on the internet, once you've put a picture or an image out there, it doesn't take long for someone to find it. So be careful of what you release into the community, even if it's a Snapchat. You know, I think you can screenshot, some of that stuff. So you got to be careful. Word to the wise.
Yeah. Well, if you go to my blog, it's on the, I've got a picture of me running in some tights and on the, you know, on the cover of the blog. So I'm not afraid. I mean, I had some good races, and part of that was intimidation and feeling fast. It's like some guys shave their legs. I got the same sensation when wearing tights. So.
Was there anything in the Alpine racing community that was there intimidation out there, Jim? Was there some strategies that you recognized as you developed your education? Could you look back or look forward and say, that guy or gal doesn't even know they're doing that, but that's a very good strategy. Did you have a new set of spectacles to watch the community after you received your education?
Without a doubt, and I look back on it, and I find it in endurance sports as well, is that the really great athletes, they carry themselves a certain way. There's a confidence that they have, a calmness that they have, a certainty that they have, that they just know they're going to run fast, ski fast, whatever the sport is, and that comes obviously from success and tremendous preparation. And just knowing that they have all their ducks in a row, and that whatever comes at them today, that they're ready for it. And certainly with trail running, that's absolutely essential because of the variable conditions that the trail runners can experience in a race, whether it's incredible heat, rain, snow, obviously elevation change, descending or climbing. So that kind of confidence that comes from incredible preparation and knowing yourself is fundamental to success in trail running.
Now, I've asked this question before, and I'm going to ask it again in maybe a slightly different angle, certainly to a different person with your background. Do you think an athlete would benefit more from being 10% fitter or physically more capable versus 10% tougher, psychologically more prepared?
Wow, great question. That's a tough one, because I often speak to groups of athletes, and I always say, how important is the mental side of endurance sports, of running, compared to the physical side? And interestingly enough, the vast majority say it's more important. But even as a sports psychologist, I don't believe the mental side is more important, because you can have all the mental preparation in the world, but if you're not physically capable of going the distance at the pace you want, then the mental stuff doesn't matter. But it is an essential piece of the puzzle. So I guess I'm a little stymied, because certainly an essential part is, if you have 10% more fitness, that's a big improvement if you think about 10% faster on a course. At the same time, if you don't have the toughness, the mental toughness to access that fitness, and if you don't believe you have that fitness so you can push yourself, if you don't think you can get through the pain, through the discomfort, then the 10% fitness doesn't matter. So ideally, you want to get as fit as you possibly can and be as mentally prepared as you can. And is that going to guarantee top of the podium? No. But is it very likely going to guarantee, or at least incredibly greatly ensure, that you're going to have a really good race? No doubt.
So I'm going to make it even a bit tougher and put a third option on this, and throw it over to Ian and let him handle it, because I think I'd like to hear his response. So I think in this case, you have 10% physical, 10% tougher, but maybe per 10% better decision making. Because I think that ultimately, with the endurance sport and being out there for X hours, decision making and making right choices could be more beneficial than either of the other two options. What do you think, Ian?
I agree. Especially as the distance of the event grows, we have to make a lot more decisions, like Ironman and 100-mile races versus 5Ks and 10Ks. You can certainly make mistakes in those races as well, but they're not magnified as great as say not fueling or eating correctly in the first 30 miles of a 100-mile race. Those are some pretty big issues. I don't know. I guess it applies to 5Ks as well. I mean, you can blow a 5K if you run the first mile too fast. Decision making is important.
John, let me add a little something to that one.
Please.
Is that, for me, decision making is part of the psychology of it, because certainly I've done a couple of Ironmans and a bunch of marathons, and pretty much after about 8 hours into an Ironman, all bets are off. Your ability to think clearly is severely challenged, and I'm sure this is the case with 50 to 100 mile ultra runs, because your physiology is breaking down, and our psychology is fundamentally physiological and neurological, and so having a plan is so important. For example, I'm sure Ian has experienced this, where 8 to 10 hours into an Ironman, and when you're just starting the marathon part of it, pretty much whatever kind of food or drink you have tastes awful. And that at that point, your body just doesn't want to ingest it. And yet your ability to have in place a regimented plan of fueling, for example, will help with that decision making, because it's just like, oh, it's at the half hour mark of the marathon. I need to fuel. That's what my plan is, versus, do I do it? Do I not do it? I don't feel like it. I'm not feeling good. Because as with endurance trail running and longest ultra runs and Ironmans and the like, your rationality, your cerebral cortex, your ability to think clearly gets peeled away, and you become very, very primitive. And it's all emotional stuff at that point. And the ability to think clearly when you're in that highly vulnerable emotional state is extremely difficult. And that's why if you have a plan in place where this is just what you do, then it's much easier to make those decisions, because in a way they're already made.
Is there a way for us to stay engaged and prolong that period of being a non-thinker and irrational? Do you have a trick for us, or something
way to prolong
we can do? Yeah, and so that we can stay engaged longer, so that that point of the race when all bets are off and our thoughts are scrambled. Is there a way to stay in tune longer?
Yeah, I believe in having that plan in advance. So in a way, again, you don't have to make the decision. This is just what you do at certain points in the race. But also having cues. So I would put, I had tape on my handlebars of my tri bike that says fuel or eat or breathe or drink or smile. And a couple of reminders that when you get so wrapped up in the discomfort and the boredom and the monotony of being out there for anywhere from the top guys do 8 hours up to the people who do 17 hours, which is the limit of an Ironman. And then for an ultra run, when you're out there for 12 to 24 hours, these little reminders sort of engage your executive functioning, that part of your brain that enables you to make deliberate decisions when your body is telling your mind, hey, this is just, we're caveman again. We're just trying to survive. And so that really helps, having those cues, having people along the way who can tell me, like my wife will be at a certain point in the race going, remember to eat, remember to breathe, smile, anything to re-engage that executive functioning, that ability to make those decisions that will ultimately help you get to the finish line safely.
It's a lot easier for those of us who have done this kind of racing. We've gotten to that 8 hour or 17 hour or 24 hour point in an event where these things are happening and we have to remind ourselves and we need people to help remind ourselves. Is there any way for the first timer, like the newbie, to practice this before they actually experience it?
Yeah, great question. And clearly, for the newbie, nobody knows what it's like to run 50 miles or to do an Ironman until you've done one. And what you want to do is simulate it as much as possible through training. And I haven't done a lot of ultra running, but my experience has been that nobody goes out and does a 50 miler for training for a 50 miler. But to go out and run the hyper distance, that's the term I use, longer than would be normally expected in a training program. So the body and the mind can get used to going that distance. And so those kind of experiences give them experience of what it's going to be like in a race before they get there. And so any kind of simulations that will create that. Also, again, having those plans built into training runs, going out on the trail and knowing that I'm going to fuel every time my watch goes off every 20 minutes, or I'm going to walk the steep hills, or I'm going to talk to somebody along the way. So the more they can build those experiences into their training, the more it'll become ingrained, because that in a way is a skill. The skill of ultra running, the skill of long distance endurance sports, is being able to be aware, being able to make good decisions, being able to do what's best for you along the way. And ultimately, the best way is through experience, but you can't get experience until you go do it. And before you do that, you need to prepare for it, and you can build some of these things into training.
In the article, you talk a bit about, did you have a follow-up, Ian? I don't want to...
Nope, that was good.
Yeah. Yeah. In your article, you talk a bit about prime versus peak in training and preparation. And I think that's an important distinction, and I really like how you broke that down. Can you talk about that for us?
Yeah, coming out of grad school, that peak performance was what I wanted to achieve. That's what everybody talks about. It's become a part of our culture, our athletic culture, our achievement culture. It's in the business world now. But as I became more experienced as a psychologist and as a writer, I came to appreciate the power of words. And that it's very important that the words we use are highly descriptive of what we're trying to communicate. So I decided that peak performance wasn't what I wanted my athletes to achieve. And so if you think about peak performance, I'm holding my hands up. So you think of a mountain peak. Some problems with it are there's only one point at the top. Also, when you get there, there's only one way to go, and that's down. And third, you can peak too early or too late. And I work with some athletes who in previous events had peaked too early or too late. And so I decided that peak performance wasn't a phrase that was descriptive of what I wanted my athletes to achieve. And then I struggled for a couple of years coming up with a phrase that worked. I tried to stay in the geographic domain, so I thought of like Mesa performance or Butte performance, but those didn't quite work for me either. And then one day I was in the grocery store, and I had one of those meetings of timing and readiness, and I was walking through the meat section of the grocery store, and I saw this sticker on a piece of steak that said prime cut. And I had one of these aha experiences. And I went back to my office, looked up the word prime, and it was defined as of the highest quality or value. of the highest quality or value. So I finally came up with a phrase that worked for me, prime performance. And here's how I define prime performance: performing at a consistently high level under the most challenging conditions. Performing at a consistently high level under the most challenging conditions. Now, there are two important words in that definition that are so important for trail running. First is consistency, that you need to go out there and just perform at a consistent level in terms of your running, your pace, your fueling, rather than the big ups and downs where people are walking for a while, they're running for a while, and they're dragging for a while. So consistency is really important. And I'm sure that's one thing that's made Ian such a phenomenal ultra runner. Second is challenging. It is how they respond in challenging conditions, because the very nature of trail running is the immense challenges, physical, geographical, etc. And so what I want athletes to achieve, this is the goal I strive for them to achieve, is achieving prime performance, being able to perform consistently at a high level under the most challenging conditions. I find that that is something that athletes can wrap their arms around. And it's also very specific. It's sort of very controllable. Like, there are things I can do here versus I'm not sure I can time it just right to reach my peak.
I think the term peak really puts a variable into the equation. That is, if I'm ready for this race, that peak is a very fine point. So I might go in psychologically not as confident because that peak has such a point to it. But the prime allows me to feel prepared. I can rely on my preparation. I've psychologically done all my imagery, and I feel confident. And so I think your word prime means I'm just fit and ready and mentally prepared for this challenge. Peak is a gamble. You've got to really nail that thing. That's what I take from that.
Very good.
How about you, Ian, with your athletes? Do you find that finding peak is different for each one of them, or do you have any experience with the peak preparation or you know, race preparation for your athletes?
It's interesting the terminology we're using, because you know, when you're building a training program and you're getting close to race day, like 2 weeks out, you know, the term that is often thrown around is tapering. And Greg McMillan, my mentor and my boss, termed the coin peaking instead of tapering, because tapering is you're just whittling away at something, and peaking has a different connotation to it. And now, talking and hearing Dr. Taylor talk, it's maybe we should just call it priming. I think terminology is really important. It's like when, you know, what I was just saying earlier in the podcast about being asked how I feel, how am I going to do when we're on, you know, the start line and people asking me these questions and, you know, saying, I don't know how I feel, things haven't been going that great. Those are all things that you're saying openly, but they're affecting your psyche and, you know, peaking, priming, tapering, all those things do the same thing as well.
Hey, Dr. Jim, let's talk about words that come out of our mouths and words that stay in our head. Is there communication that happens internally that could really sabotage us a great deal? Are there ways to turn that around? Are there ways to change our circumstances and situations based on dialogue that we create ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly in an endurance event such as an ultra run or trail run, what you say to yourself has a huge impact on your ability to just continue to put one step in front of the other. Because going back to that idea that during long runs, we go primitive, is that our human's fundamental instinct is to survive. And back in the day, when we were on the Serengeti 250,000 years ago, survival meant all about just physical survival. But now it's much more than that. And when you're out on a long run, let's say a 50K, and your body is getting worn down. Now, your body doesn't know that you actually are doing this, you actually chose to do this. All your body knows is that it feels like it's heading toward death. So it starts communicating to your mind saying, we can stop now. And that's where pain comes in, as an example. And so, because the body thinks it's going to die. And so it continues to send this message. You got to stop. You got to stop. You got to stop. And if the mind goes, oh my gosh, I'm in pain. This is terrible. This is really hurting. Then the chances are you're going to stop, or at least you're going to ease up. And in which case, in either case, you're not going to achieve your race goals. But if your mind can assert control of your body and say, no, I've trained for this. I know it's going to hurt, but I'm prepared for this and I'm going to keep going. So you, body, need to keep going. Then it's going to keep going. Because again, that self-talk is so important. If you start going, I can't do this, I'm hurting, I hate this, this is terrible, you're going to what I call the dark side. And especially in ultra running and trail running, you go to the dark side. And when you go to the dark side, then that means you just go to this dark place of negativity and where you're turning against yourself. And if you turn against yourself, the trail's against you, the conditions are against you, if you're against you, you've got no chance. And so the ability, it's such a cliche, you know, think positively, but that's what you have to do. And when I talk about thinking positively, I don't mean say things like, oh, I'm having a great time out here, this is so fun, because I know that feeling from Ironmans, it's no fun. There's no joy the last couple of hours of an Ironman, that's for sure. But if you can say things, I'm working toward my goals, I'm keeping moving forward, one step at a time, I'm going to finish this, I'm going to finish strong, I'm going to make this. These sort of realistic positive statements can make a huge impact on your ability to just keep yourself moving forward and overcoming a lot of the pain that you're inevitably experiencing.
Oh, that's good stuff. You know, this is not going to defeat me. I am bigger, I am better than this, and I'm not going to carry this with me for an eternity that I was not able to push through this. Yeah, that's powerful mental fuel, I think. And I love that saying that you said, go primitive. I mean, if that isn't a hashtag in the making, I really like that. Did you just come up with that, or has that been something that you have spoken about a long time? I like it.
Oh, the whole caveman primitive thing is something I talk about all the time with athletes I work with and in my talks, because, you know, we like to think we're these highly evolved beings with these well-developed cerebral cortexes on the top of our head. But we are, in terms of the evolution, you know, we 250,000 years is a blimp, not a blimp. And and so we are still very much animals, especially when our quote unquote life is threatened, when we're challenged, and which inevitably occurs in a trail run.
Cool.
So Dr. Taylor, you talked about four ways in another one of your articles, four ways of handling or dissociating with pain: external focus, rhythmic cognitive activity, dramatic coping, and situational assessment. Can you touch on those? I think the audience would like to learn ways and play with these ways, different ways in their training and racing, and you know, getting a grip on their own pain scales.
Yeah. I mean, certainly for long distance trail running, pain is. The ability to manage pain is one of those essential mental skills, and it's one thing I'm sure you're unbelievable at, given your experience and your record. And a couple things to think about pain. First of all, pain is something that we have control over when we run. That we can easily stop the pain by just stopping or slowing down. But people think of pain as this physical experience. But there's a ton of research that has shown that it's filtered through our minds, that how we perceive the pain influences how we experience the pain. So as an example, research has shown that what we think about our pain and the emotions we associate with our pain influences our experience of the pain. So if we connect negative thoughts and negative emotions with pain, we actually feel more pain. And so if we're hurting, which is inevitable in a, let's say, a 50K trail run, and we start thinking that this is terrible, I hate this, then we're going to feel more pain. If you start getting anxious and afraid and frustrated and angry, you're going to feel more pain. So two very simple techniques to deal with pain are to, first of all, associate positive thoughts with it. And again, as I said before, they need to be realistic. It's not realistic to say, oh, this feels so good. because it doesn't. But to see it as a challenge, to see yourself pushing, to see yourself moving toward your goals. So associating positive, realistic thoughts with it. Also, try to generate some positive emotions. And this is incredibly difficult because the typical positive emotions such as excitement, joy, happiness, serenity, they're just not in the cards late in a long race. I'm sorry. I've known that feeling and it just ain't going to happen, as they say. Mm-hmm. So I try to think about what are two emotions, positive emotions you could generate realistically when you're in a lot of pain. And the two I came up with was inspiration and pride. That it's inspiring having put in all that time in training and you're moving ahead and you're working toward your goals. That's inspiring. And also having pride in that effort and that pride of what you're going to feel like when you cross the finish line. Because there's one emotion that's the worst possible emotion to experience, and that's regret. And that happens to a lot of endurance athletes when they walk, when they quit, even though they've got fuel in the tank, or where they slow up when they could have gone faster to the finish line. Because that regret means, I wish I had done something differently. So in that moment, when there's that conflict, that challenge, think, okay, I am going to keep going. I'm going to take pride in my efforts. And that creates positive emotions. It changes the neurophysiology, and you feel less pain. Another little side note, Ian mentioned about dissociation. And this is what a lot of newbies try to do, is they try to distract themselves by listening to music, by just daydreaming. And the research shows is that distraction can work for a while to distract you from your pain. But the body has a tremendous capacity to turn up the volume when it's in pain. So it will start screaming at you, and in your mind at some point the distraction doesn't work. And what the research shows is that the most experienced endurance athletes, they associate with the pain. They use the pain as information to adjust their pace, to adjust their body position, to adjust their stride. And by using pain as information, that engages the intellectual, the cognitive part of the brain, which redirects a lot of those pain signals away from the primitive part of the brain, which is just saying, stop, my life is threatened here, to the ability to think through and use that information to help them get where they want to go. So distraction can work for a little while, but ultimately doesn't work. And the best endurance athletes use that information from the pain to help them continue along and make adjustments.
Manipulating what they're doing in a positive way, I say manipulating, to move that pain and move it from the scale so it's lower and you can tolerate it better. But that pain is essentially a critical warning sign that you're about to crash in ways that you're not going to be able to pull yourself out of if you don't acknowledge it. So distracting yourself is what you're saying is a certain way to blow up unless you really take it in and process it and change it.
Exactly. And a big part of this whole pain process is this acute problematic pain where I need to stop, whether it's an ankle or a knee or a hip, or is this simply exertion pain that, you know, that's part of the deal? Because the fact is, guys, we wouldn't do endurance sports if it was easy. We do it because it's hard and not because it's not because it's necessarily good for our body, but up to a point. But because it's good for our heart, our soul, our minds, that it again inspires us. It gives us, makes us feel very, very prideful in the positive sense. It makes us feel good about ourselves. And so the ability to overcome these challenges of endurance running, of trail running, is again why we do it. And the ability to keep that perspective when you're really hurting is so important, because the fact is, we choose to do it. We often pay lots of money to suffer out there.
Mm-hmm.
And why? Because ultimately, whether you want to call it your soul, your spirit, your mind, your heart, we do it because it fulfills that part of us that needs fulfilling.
If I may submit something from a previous podcast when we had Dr. Tim Noakes on, we asked him the question, what's the right distance? What's a good distance for our bodies? You know, what's healthy for us? And he said, you know, a person shouldn't have to run any further than a half marathon. I mean, you can get all the health benefits that you would like, but there's something very special that happens past that distance in the mind that you can't reproduce in 13 miles. And I've always held on to that comment and thought that was a great perspective.
That is a wonderful one, because the fact is, being able to run 50 miles has absolutely no practical value to us except to run 50 miles. And I know now I've got young kids that, I get out a couple times a week on the trails for, 10, 15 miles total in the week. And I don't feel any worse than I did when I was, running marathons and doing Ironmans. And in many cases, I probably feel a little better because I'm not wearing myself out. So the reason we do distance is totally not for physical reasons. It's more for psychological and spiritual reasons. And there's great value in that for sure.
In your discussion on pain, you talked about performance pain and warning pain, and you kind of hit on that a moment ago, but I liked the term warning pain, because a warning pain, there is no confusion. Is this good for me or bad for me? There, we often talk about, well, what's bad, or what kind of pain should I be able to run through or not run through? I think warning pain is very distinct and cannot be confused with performance pain. Warning pain is. Go ahead.
It would be great to touch on this, because I work, I'm a coach as well, and I work with a lot of athletes. And I learned at a young age, because I started running in junior high school, what pain was all about. And, it took me a while to learn what injury was. And, is this just something you need to run through, or is it something that you should stop and seek help on? And I think a lot of new runners have a hard time telling the difference.
Yeah, and it's a real challenge, because very often the pain is very clear, like, this really hurts, I need to stop. But often it's much more subtle. It's this chronic thing where it just keeps hurting and keeps hurting, but I'm sort of able to run through it for a while anyway. But it creates this real conflict, because that pain is contradicting their desire and their motivation to want to strive toward their goals and finish a race or even get to the start of a race. And so runners have a tremendous amount of angst about that pain, because they don't want to be wimpy, they don't want to have to quit, they want to be able to get to the start and then get on the trail and then finish and achieve their goals. So that's where pain is a pain, if you will, in that it creates this angst where athletes, the runners, should listen to it and stop, but they don't want to because it contradicts their goals. And that's where experience comes in, because I think the more experience you have, the more you realize that, as Don, you suggest, this is warning pain. I need to stop. I need to rest. I need to take a couple weeks off, whatever it might be. But for newbies, for either young athletes or newer endurance athletes, they don't know what that is exactly. They can't necessarily differentiate it. And so then that's when they often will run when they shouldn't, and that they need to go see a PT or just take some time off to recover.
And performance pain. Go ahead, Ian, go ahead.
Can you describe the difference between the bad pain and the good pain? You call it performance pain being the good pain, but can you describe the difference?
Yeah. Warning pain is very, very painful, usually. It happens immediately. It's where your body is screaming at you to stop, and it's preventing you from, let's say, maintaining stride or maintaining body position. Performance pain or exertion pain is generally longer term. It's definitely lower grade. If you stop, it stops. Whereas with the injury pain, with the warning pain, the pain often persists. Exertion pain doesn't last after the workout typically, except maybe for a little soreness. And so it's much more manageable or sustainable. And your body is not screaming at warning. With warning pain, your body's screaming at you to stop. With exertion pain, your body's saying, hey, you know what? This is not feeling very good. We should stop now. Come on, please. So it's a different kind of communication from your body.
But may I share from experience that sometimes performance pain can disguise itself very, very well into making you want to think that it's warning pain so that you can take a sit down for a while and take a little rest. That performance pain can be elusive and disguised.
Without a doubt. And that's, again, where experience comes in, that you learn over time. Well, is this really my body telling me that something's seriously wrong, or is it just telling me that this hurts some?
So on that pain discussion, you put in this article here, and again, it'll be linked, and you can find these things over on Dr. Taylor's website, and we'll link everything on the show notes. But you talk about how we can eradicate or disperse or get rid of some of this pain while we're actually in the event. Do you have some strategies?
Yeah, like I said earlier, creating some positive associations with emotions and thoughts help. Also, breathing is a very powerful tool, because when our body starts to break down during a trail run, we lose control of it. And breathing is the one physiological component that we can control. And it can have a direct impact on our perception of pain with breathing. When we are in pain, our body starts to tighten up. It braces itself because it feels like it's threatened. So breathing relaxes our muscles. And when we relax our muscles, we feel less pain. Also, simply the act of relaxing calms us down, reduces some of our anxiety or fear about the pain. And plus, psychologically, it makes us feel more in control, which just makes us feel better, because we tend to become anxious when we're feeling less in control. So breathing is a very, very simple yet powerful strategy that it's such an obvious thing for life, but we often forget about how, at a very practical level, at a very conscious level, it can really help us in our running.
Good stuff. Ian, do you have any tips for your athletes or yourself that you've used to manage the pain?
But Dr. Taylor's covered everything. He talks about massage as well, and that's something that I don't do, that I probably should do more of. And I was also interested in hearing his describing or discussing the act of relaxation, and it is counterintuitive, the tensing of the muscles and then relaxing them.
Right.
That technique I've not heard of.
Yeah, this is actually a strategy that I found really, really useful. This especially I find with my arms and shoulders. Late in an endurance event, when you've been out there 15, 20, 30, 40 miles, you've been just basically doing the same thing repetitively, stride, 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 that your body starts to rebel against it. And that one thing you can do to help that quell the rebellion, if you will, is to move your body around, change your body position, swing your arms, shrug your shoulders, as well as another interesting thing that happens is, as you get farther into an endurance event, your muscles start to tighten up more and more. And it's hard to just shake them out and relax them, because your body is really feeling threatened, so it continues to brace itself. So one thing that I call active relaxation, in the research they call it progressive relaxation, is instead of trying to relax your muscles, where at that point in a race, it's probably, you can't just relax your muscles. If it was that easy, your body would just do it. So do just the opposite. Instead of trying to relax, let's say, your neck and shoulders, which are starting to get really tight, tighten them up even farther. So you're running along, and for 5 seconds, as you're striding along, you just tighten your neck and shoulders up. And then you shrug them and let them relax. Take a deep breath. Do that a couple of times. Because our body works on what's called an opponent principle process, a little jargon there. But basically the idea is that, let's say if you want your shoulder muscles and your neck muscles to be at, say, a 4, but right now they're at about an 8 or a 7, that instead of just being able to get them down to a 4, you tighten them way up and then relax them, they rebound past, you tighten them up to a 10 and then relax them, they rebound past that 7 or 8 down closer to a 4. So it's somewhat counterintuitive. Why would you tighten your muscles up to relax your muscles? but it actually is really effective. And during a long trail run, being able to change up your body, move your body around, it's a great way to break up the tension as well.
Would you recommend doing this proactively before you have those muscles that are tightening up, just kind of learning your body and implement this strategy beforehand? Is that something you've done?
Absolutely. The best way to deal with a lot of these problems is to prevent them. So very conscious, deliberate breathing during and over the top of a long climb, changing your stride. And the nice thing about a trail run, unlike a flat road race, is your stride is constantly changing, so that helps. Because I find also 20 miles into a flat marathon, my legs are just getting tired of being at that same stride. And so what I'll do is I'll shorten my stride up, I'll lengthen my stride for a little while, I'll break up the monotony of that repetitive position and stride. Also, just, you know, every mile or every 15 minutes, I'll shake out my arms, I'll swing my arms around. So this sort of prevents your body from rusting, if you will. It breaks up the rust before it's really set in, when it might in fact be too late if you wait till it really, your body really starts to rebel.
Those are good tips. As we close up here, what's attracted you to the trail, Dr. Taylor? As you started out on some skis and on a snowy mountain, what do you love about the trail?
It's funny you asked that, Don, because I had run all my life as part of training for my ski racing, but then I lived in Aspen for a number of years, and I'd never raced in a running race in my life up until my mid-30s, and I would just go up in the trails, and for me, I always ran alone, had a bunch of water bottles, I started going farther and farther, and there was just the sense of just being in nature, being in the moment, putting the world's cares behind me, because if you're running on a road or a track, there are cars, there are people, life is there. But to be able to be out on a trail for me is this incredible relief and release where I can just clear my mind. And it's interesting because I do some of my best thinking, creative thinking, when I'm running, where I just get these ideas about something I want to write about or a new idea. And so I would go out for running the trails in Colorado for 3-4 hours. And then somebody said, you should do a running race. And I said, no, I don't want to do a running race. I know it'll happen because I'm a competitive guy. Well, I got talked into this 5K and it happened exactly what I thought would happen. I started getting competitive and I started doing 10Ks and half marathons and marathons and Ironmans and so on. But since I've had kids and I'm not competing at all these days, this ability to just let go of all the stuff that goes on in my life and just experience this joy and this freedom of just being in nature. And so that for me is really what it's about. And it's something that I find I can't get on a bike. I can get a skate skiing on the trails up in Tahoe, but that's a little more complicated because it's sort of more technical. Whereas running is something, you know, kids, you know, it's running is child's play. So there's nothing like running the trails for me.
Hashtag go primitive, it sounds like to me. I like it. Anything else from you, Ian? Do you have any final thoughts or questions?
Yes, I have one more question. So you have 14 books. Is there a resource, a single resource you would recommend for an audience like us, trail runners, that kind of sums up what we just talked about today?
Yeah, if you go to my blog under endurance sports, that's one of the categories in my blog, and you will find that I cover a lot of these issues in which you can learn more about these things. Probably of all the different books, my triathlon book, obviously it's not about trail running, but certainly about endurance sports. And my Prime Sport book, which is sort of a general book related to all different sports, those are probably the best resources. But if you go to my blog and just do a search for endurance sports, you'll come up with a lot of pretty fun stuff.
Great. Very, very Thanks. Generous. Yeah, very generous with all your information. And you also do some other things besides just endurance coaching or speaking. You also have a bit to do with some parenting books or different things. Can you touch on that?
Yeah. My work with young athletes turned into working with their parents. And since then, I've written 4 parenting books on a variety of topics, ranging from positive pushing, how to raise a successful and happy child, to the role of popular culture with kids. My last book is called Raising Generation Tech, and it's about the impact of technology on kids these days. And a lot of this ties in with kids being physically active. And it's funny, with my career, I've never really had a clear path. I've just sort of followed my passions and opportunities. And so I am a parent now of 2 young girls, and that's obviously very important to me. And but really, sports and parenting are the 2 areas that are very close to my heart, and I feel very, very deeply about.
Awesome stuff. Ian Torrence at iantorrence.blogspot.com, Reinventing the Run. Thanks for joining us today and co-hosting with Dr. Jim Taylor, who can be found at drjimtaylor.com. More readings on 750 articles, 14 books, thousands of workshops, and you can see why. He's just a wealth of information and really speaks to the things that we do as trail runners. I found all of this fascinating and really appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Don. I'm glad to come back at any time in the future.
Thank you very much. Now go out and run.
Boss.
Dang, Ian, you hit that right on the mark.